I'm Rob Dietz.
I'm Jason Bradford.
And I'm Ashara Miller. Welcome to Crazy Town, where Joe Exotic is the leading candidate for mayor.
Go, Joe!
This is producer Melody Travers. In this season of Crazy Town, Jason, Ashara, and Rob are exploring the watershed moments in history that have led humanity into the cascading crises we face in the 21st century. Today's episode is about the domination of animals, the way people regard themselves as being above nature, and how we can change the story from control to coexistence. The watershed moment took place 6,000 years ago. At the time, the estimated carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere was 263 parts per million, and the global human population was 17.5 million.
Hey, Jason, Ashara, I want you to hold that watershed date in mind for a few minutes because I got a little preamble here for you, a little prelude, an intro story.
All right.
Okay, so you know that I love animals. I love seeing them in the wild, and I'll even every once in a while break down and go observe them in a zoo. Okay?
Sure, yeah.
And I used to live in D.C., and it's really cool. They got the Smithsonian Institution, and the zoo is free there.
Yeah.
So every once in a while, I'd be biking home from work, and I actually would pass the zoo, and I'd be like, I'm going to stop in and see some animals.
Yeah, I could do that in St. Louis, too. Yeah. It was fantastic.
Okay. It was free there, too?
Yeah, free there, too.
So this one day, I lock up my bike, I go into the zoo, and I see there's a little crowd gathered around this exhibit, and I'm like, I wonder what's over there. So I wander over and I'm at the back of the crowd, but I'm kind of up on this little sloping hill. And so I can see into this exhibit. And it's not one of these good modern ones with habitat. It's seriously like concrete walls.
Sure.
with a little cage that you could see through.
Easy to clean that way.
I guess. And the animal that's in there, I have a direct view to it. It's a pygmy hippopotamus.
Fantastic.
Beautiful little, it's just what it sounds like. It's a miniature hippo. It's like, it weighs a lot more, but it's sort of the size of a big dog or something. Okay. So all these people are like crowded right around the gate looking at this pygmy hippo. And I'm behind them thinking, wow, I wonder what that hippo is feeling. And then it decided to tell us. It backed up away from the people into one of these concrete walls. So it was just like backing away and its butt then hits this wall. And then I could only describe it as a disgusting brown waterfall of diarrhea poo just starts pouring out of this animal's butt.
Rob's, every story from Rob involves...
You gotta expect it. You just gotta expect it now.
It follows me.
Yeah.
Well, and so that was bad enough. Yeah. But then it turns out that this hippo tail, it can flap it faster than like a metal drummer can hit a drum. It starts just like paddling its tail against this wall, and this waterfall of poo just sprays out over the crowd.
Fantastic.
And awesome. That's my favorite hippo.
I'm just out of range, thankfully, and I'm just laughing. And all these people are just like, oh, God, and they just start running and making a mess. And I couldn't tell you for sure, but I think that the hippo then had this self-satisfied smile on its face.
Well, I can tell you that is the territorial behavior of hippos. That's how they mark their territory.
Well, see, there you go.
There we go. So it had claimed that zoo yard.
Well,
those people.
Yeah.
And the reason this is a good preamble for this is that the zoo is often a shit show.
Yes. Yes. Well, that brings us then to the watershed moment, right? We're talking long before pharaohs came into power, 4000 BCE, the city of Nekhen. I hope I said that right. Are the ancient Egyptians going
to
be upset with me?
They're not around to complain.
Okay.
Yeah. Also, well, try the Greek translation.
It's also known as Hierakonpolis.
Oh,
Hierakonpolis.
Hierakonpolis. Thank you.
I think it's just Konpolis.
Okay, wait. Here's an English version of this. City of the Falcon.
Oh, I like that. You got that one right.
That
I
one
think.
I could really found. Okay.
Or is it Falcon?
If I'm Sean Connery. Well, it was most one of the most thriving cities in pre-dynastic Egypt, south of Luxor, great name, and located along the Nile River. Well, archaeologists, they discovered something quite fascinating. There were elite members of society. So we're not pharaoh elite, but, you know, pretty good. Kardashians or whatever.
Okay.
And
the Kardashian scale.
Yeah, Kardashian scale. They found among these, you know, dead elites, they all die, bones of baboon, elephant covered in, get this, cosmetics, and ivory bracelets and amethyst
beads. They put makeup on the elephant?
Makeuped elephants.
Wow.
Yes. So they.
Are you sure this wasn't like one of this person's wives? I stumped him.
He doesn't know about the culture. He can't even pronounce the name of the city, as if he has insights into what was going on there.
Yeah.
The elephant bride.
Yeah, I had a frozen moment there. Anyway, they had leopards and crocodiles and aurochs and hippos.
Yeah, see, maybe the hippo needed to mark its territory a little better.
Yeah, all kinds of stuff. So this site has now become recognized as the oldest zoo. The oldest
kind of the beginnings of the zoo.
Yes. So it's likely it wasn't exactly like current zoos, you know, where it's this institution with all these barriers. They probably had these animals tied up, you know, and in some way and penned.
I love what these archaeologists do. They're like, oh, the baboon had a broken hand. And then they describe like a Forensic Files type scene in which they know exactly what happened to this animal as if they've got that much insight.
A lot of inference about how the animals were kept based upon, you know, wearing and tearing of limbs. But anyhow, it's considered then this place where people kept these kind of wild animals close to these elites.
And we're talking about 1,000 years before the pharaohs, basically.
Okay. So long, yeah.
Yeah, a long time ago.
Long time ago.
Okay, but before we continue down this path, I have to issue a warning that maybe I should have done at the top of the episode, but we don't tend to warn our listeners about our filthy language or our doom and gloom attitudes.
Or your constant reference to bowel movements.
Yeah. Poop jokes are all over the place, but I do want to issue a warning early in this episode that we're going to talk about some pretty hard to take treatment of animals. And even though, you know, we're still going to try to keep our lighthearted nature here, there's some pretty gnarly stuff. So
yeah, people can be pretty shitty themselves sometimes. It's kind of hard, you know, to think about what we've done as to others. So yeah.
So anyway. So back to ancient times and our mistreatment of animals.
So you were saying that, is there actual evidence that these animals were somehow abused? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. There's definitely, you know, suggestions that based upon broken bones and lesions, whatever, you know, that that they may have been tied up or whatever, beaten.
I think finding cosmetically adjusted elephant suggests abuse
elephant
could have asked for.
That's like people dressing up their chihuahua, right? Okay, you know, they do it out of love. And so I think this, yeah. Anyway, okay, don't make too many assumptions.
Right. Well, I mean, I think, you know, so you're talking about 4,000 BCE, quite a long time ago. We've seen evidence from societies across the world, across the globe, that similar types of things were happening. It wasn't just in what is now thought of as ancient Egypt, but all over Mesopotamia, in China, what is now China, and Persia, and even Mesoamerica, right?
Yeah.
There's evidence of animals being kept, you know, as displays of wealth and status and imperial ambition, all kinds of animals in different places, you know. So it seems like it's quite a commonplace phenomenon, you know.
I think it creates a sense of awe. Think about it. You're an emperor on a throne and one of your subjects comes in. Maybe it's a lord you emperor over, and they don't have a freaking elephant sitting next to them. You know, or a giant panda you're feeding little bamboo scraps.
Yeah.
It must be pretty, Yeah, it'd be pretty awe-inspiring.
It even happened a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away when Jabba the Hutt had that Rancor monster in his palace.
There you go. It's throughout the galaxy issue. This is a galactic issue.
And it stretched all the way up to, you know, Michael Jackson's Neverland Ranch, right?
Yeah.
He had his own little zoo there. And
yeah.
I think I heard a story about some teenager in Dubai who's... family is uber wealthy, and he's got his own little zoo. And I shouldn't call it a little zoo. I mean, it's a big fucking zoo for this 13-year-old kid.
Oh, BFZ?
Yes. You know.
Oh, yeah.
You've heard a million times.
And our favorite drug kingpin, Pablo Escobar, you know, he was into this.
Right.
So.
Hippos, baby.
Yeah.
Hippos.
Yeah.
I want to talk about one of the first sort of modern zoos, which popped up in Vienna, the Tiergarten Schönbrunn.
Tiergarten Schönbrunn.
Okay, you're good. You're as good as I am.
Schönbrunn. So this is in the late 18th century. You had this guy, of course, royalty, Franz Stephan I, was the son of this Emperor Franz I. So the emperor, of course, had one of these menageries. He had like the Rancor monster under his throne, okay?
You can't be an emperor without.
Yeah, must display your power. But apparently, he didn't have a lot of carnivores. Why? Because he did not like the smell of them.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Carnivores?
Yeah, I guess, you know, maybe those cats have a musk. I don't know.
Okay.
I do not... sadly have a collection of exotic carnivores, so I don't know what the smell is. I do know the smell of pygmy hippo waterfall, and that's not good. But I digress. So this son, after I guess Papa left the earth, son decides, well, we got all these animals, and I could add to this. I could bring in some of those carnivores because the smell doesn't bother me. And he basically takes that collection and his son works on it. And basically they make this public display. So you got the first zoo running there in the 1800s.
So this is a transition to keeping animals in these sort of private zoos to suddenly like, oh no, we're going to let the public in.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We're going to let people see them. And, you know, of course that's utterly expanded over the ages into modern times. You've got the, you know, well over, gosh, I don't have the number in front of me. Well over 200 accredited zoos and aquariums in the United States or in North America, and that's just accredited ones. You know.
Now, accreditation, that sounds kind of nice. Like there's some standards being set for treatment. You know, there's professionalism, but we also kind of have the dark side of this. With I don't know, anyone ever watched that? What's it called? The Tiger King.
Never heard of that.
Yeah.
Talk about in the cultural moment, like zeitgeist.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, fantastic. But I had, but there are other situations I've been in where it's sort of like, I was walking through Louisiana State University one time. This was in the mid 90s. And they had this tiger, because it's the LSU Tigers, just in this concrete cage, and they would walk it out for football games. So even beyond zoos or like this these private animal parks, you know, there are these displays that we have as a culture
state. Yeah, I saw the same thing. Like I said, I used to live in DC, and the royalty there, of course, are the politicians. And this friend of mine was working on one of the committees on Capitol Hill and got invited to this New Year's party, and he invited me. It was such a weird scene. It was actually at the Hilton, the hotel where Reagan got shot.
Huh.
Now, this was years after that.
Yeah.
Like this probably.
I was going to say maybe it was somebody just hunting animals and accidentally shot Reagan.
Well, so I go in this big, you know, crummy hotel ballroom with all these politicians and all their staff, and everybody's just getting totally drunk. It's New Year's Eve, and on display is this huge glass case with a little bit of water in it and one of those albino alligators.
They brought it there?
Yeah.
Did they like take it from the Smithsonian?
What purpose?
To show status and power, probably. Maybe throw somebody in if they get out of line. I don't know.
Maybe that's a swamp that Trump was talking about draining. God.
Oh, that is funny.
It is bizarre how many of these kind of like, let's just have some crazy abuse of animals for what?
Right.
I got to say, you know, you bring up the name Michael Vick, and obviously you go to the dog fighting scandal that he was a part of. And
I think he was an American
yeah. football player.
Yeah, you gotta explain this.
Well, see, he was my guy. Yeah. So I went to school with Michael Vick.
You did?
I was a grad student at Virginia Tech.
Did you play catch with him ever?
I wish. Okay. I was a grad student at Virginia Tech when he was a freshman on the football team and became this national phenomenon. Probably the best running quarterback in history. He was super elusive. He was like Barry Sanders, but could throw the ball 60 or 70 yards.
Yeah.
So anyway, he ends up having this professional career, gets drafted by the team I grew up watching, the Atlanta Falcons. And I was like, oh, I got this connection with this sports star.
Yeah.
And then his career gets derailed because it turns out he's bankrolling and participating in a dogfighting ring.
Didn't see that one coming.
No.
Whoopsie daisy.
It goes on and on.
You know, we're talking about status and, you know, in the transition maybe from like private zoos or whatever to public zoos, there's a status thing for cities too, right? I mean, there's something about a city being able to say that we have this, you know, this destination, this tourist destination or some kind of, you know, important gem in our community is to have a zoo, right? I mean, San Diego is known, it's famous world over for its zoo. And kind of like if you're a major city and you don't have a zoo, you're like a piece of shit or something, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing how you just, like, I've never been to the San Diego Zoo, but I just know of its fame. And I swear, if I were, like, if I were starting a new city and I needed to make it prestigious, like, that's one of the first things I'm doing.
You got it. It's on the checklist along with the football stadium.
Got to get me a world-class zoo with lots of exotic animals.
Oh, yeah. St. Louis was proud of its zoo as well. So totally get it.
Well, while we're on the subject of the dark side of this kind of capturing and display of animals, I want to take you two on a little tour with one particular species. It's the beloved elephant.
Okay.
So I think almost everybody loves elephants. I mean, they look, you know, like no other animal, except maybe a mammoth, but those aren't around anymore. They are, you know, one of the most intelligent mammals on the planet.
Yeah, super intelligent, long-lived.
And they can get in these relationships with people pretty well. And so it became very popular, again, starting back in the 1800s in the United States. They became popular as display animals and
circus.
Yeah. But there's this horrible history of mistreatment. And there's an article, and we're going to get more into this, by Jill Lepore in The Atlantic. And she kind of went through some of this history. So I'm just going to share that with you guys.
Okay.
So P.T. Barnum, everyone knows him as the great circus ringleader. Well, he executed a couple of elephants in the 1880s.
Executed,
yeah. And
put him down, he executed.
Yeah, yeah. One was by firing squad in front of 2,000 spectators.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
So it's not just like a lethal dose to make them go to sleep quietly because they're old or injured or something. What? It's more like, let's make a spectacle.
Was it like a trial of this thing?
Well, think about Barnum the showman. Like, he's not going to miss this opportunity to put on another show.
So you're saying that families, the parents took their little kiddos, they went up and they got a ticket. And they're like, we're here to get tickets for the elephant massacre.
I don't know. Maybe so.
Get up front, Johnny, so you can see the blood splatter.
Hey, little Beth, your birthday's coming up. You want to see an elephant's face get blown off?
A beautiful, majestic creature get shot?
Well, okay, I'm telling you, steel yourself. It gets worse. So,
thank you.
So there was an elephant named Tip that was on display in Central Park and was actually tried and convicted for murder. I can only assume that was in sort of a sham, you know.
Of her peers? Trial.
Yeah, right. and then publicly poisoned. Yeah,
what?
Okay, here's another one named Topsy. This was the first baby elephant that was ever held in captivity in the United States. And the elephant had actually killed three men in 3 years and then was sold to a park in Coney Island where she was executed in 1903. And they really made sure on this one. They tied a noose around her neck and then they attached electrodes to her feet, and then they fed her a bunch of cyanide-laced carrots, and then hit the switch on the electrodes and electrocuted the animal.
What? I'm sorry, what the fuck is going on?
I don't know. I do know that the Edison Manufacturing Company was behind the electrocution and made a film out of it.
Jesus!
You know, because
it's an elephant snuff film.
Yeah, yeah.
God's sakes!
I know the film is available. I'm not going to put it in our links because it's just not something I care to see or have people but go watch.
Just the whole idea of saying, you know what? Maybe this elephant is too dangerous to have in captivity, right? Go from that to all of a sudden,
right?
We're gonna publicly execute this thing,
yeah,
and we're gonna do it in all of these horrific, horrific ways.
Okay, I'm gonna give you the last one here because this, you know, I think you can tell these are getting a little worse each time. So Mary was an elephant with the Sparks World Famous Shows, which was a traveling circus, and they went to Kingsport, Tennessee, which it's really weird. That's a town that I lived in for like a year or two, sort of when I was like 4 years old. So, so I guess my stomping ground. But a trainer was riding on top of Mary and sort of leading people in a parade down to where the circus was going to be held. And at some point, he hits her in the head with a stick. I don't know what the reason was, but Mary did not like that. And she grabbed him with her trunk around his waist, pulled him in front of her, smashed through him with her tusk, and trampled this guy.
Jeez, yeah.
Which, it actually, I don't know if you guys have ever seen that documentary Blackfish about orcas and how you keep them in captivity, they can go insane, basically. Mm. I think we're looking at that on some level, you know.
Well, captivity and then cruel treatment.
Yeah, right, exactly. Right. But, of course, the publicist of this wonderful circus decided to stage a public execution. And the railroad company in Kingsport was generous enough to donate a derrick from which they hanged this elephant with, of course, the spectators coming out to see it.
Yeah.
So the legs you have to go to hang an elephant, which weighs God knows how much.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, pulleys.
Sorry. What is it? Did they think it was like a lynching or something?
Hey,
like,
railroad companies have plenty of engineers.
Yeah, they can figure out.
They thought this was just a great challenge. Ooh, I've never had to do this before. That's great. I could put it on my resume.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, no, it was obviously rough. There was something going on there with horrible treatment of elephants.
Okay, so can I, lest we just go down this road of the darkest shit, which might be our tendency, just step it back for a second, because it's sort of easy to look at what we presented and say, God, you know, for the last 6,000 plus years, we've been, you know, capturing wild animals and keeping them and putting makeup on them and breaking their limbs and then displaying them for things and hanging them and doing all this awful, awful shit, which is all true. And there are probably many, many horrific stories that we don't even know about. But I guess I don't want to paint zoos with this like broad brush of like, this is just pure evil or something, right?
Right?
I think it's worth talking about.
Are you suggesting there might be nuance to a topic that we've raised?
Yeah, maybe. Well, and think about, you know, there are people, I'm sure we've all encountered people who, you know, are zoologists, people who work at zoos.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
they love animals, for God's sake.
They love animals, right? And they do it out of just incredible passion and love for the animals that they're caring for.
My grandmother was a docent at a zoo, and I remember as a little boy, she would take me there and take me backstage a little bit.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I was just enthralled with animals. I didn't see cruelty at all.
So I think we should talk a little bit about, certainly in the modern context, like what are some of the positive reasons or motivations behind zoos? What's some of the good that maybe they've offered to the world? And I guess the first place I would start is just simple education, right? I mean, we've got kids growing up in urban environments, industrialized countries, let's just talk about here in the United States, you know, who aren't exposed to nature on any level, and being able to encounter, and obviously people, there's something about megafauna, you know, that clearly resonates deeply, you know, in humans. I don't know if it sends us back to the savannah or something, but like there's something that you could take a kid from anywhere and put them in front of a giraffe or an elephant or a tiger or a lion. And there's this, you know, incredible reaction to looking at the majesty of these animals. And I think the people who offer that, want to offer those experiences to young people, I think I would venture to say in many cases, they want to instill a love of nature and wild animals.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, no, it definitely happened when my daughter was really young. I took her to the Portland Zoo, and the education was great. They had in front of, like when you got to somewhere around where the big cats were on display, they had this scale that you would step on and get your weight. Hmm. And then it would tell you which carnivore would likely eat you. So, you know, like she was going to get eaten by a cheetah. I was going to get eaten by some lions. And it was great. Yeah, really educational. But no, she loved it. Like you could see it, right? Like you could just stay there and stare at, like, they had fruit bats and you're just watching them the behavior and just taking it all in. I do think that's amazing. But I've also seen some other really cool things. Back to the Smithsonian for a bit, I was part of a program and they did a couple things there. They grew food for the zoo. You know, you were talking about getting hay earlier today. Like they'd bring in a lot of vegetation to feed the animals, but they also had an endangered species propagation program there. So you could see they were trying to figure out the genetics and trying to build up populations of maned wolf and red pandas. And I think now they have cheetahs there at the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute. And so a definite conservation mission. And I've run into some people in other parts of my career. There was one guy, become a friend of mine named Carl Treholt, who works for the Copenhagen Zoo, but he lives in Malaysia and they do all kinds of amazing biodiversity conservation work. And, you know, he's like the program director for Southeast Asia conservation, and that's funded entirely by, you know, this European zoo.
Yeah. I mean, I was in St. Louis, they had an affiliation, the zoo, with the university, and early sort of population genetics where you could test these animals. And there was all these accredited zoos then would start flying sperm around. Like, you should have your cheetah breed with our cheetah and this sort of thing.
Okay,
right?
Jason. That's as much as you get to talk about flying sperm.
Well, you
talked
about flying poop. Jeez, God, you guys are just...
I know, I'm a hypocrite.
I was just thinking about, I don't know what your guys' experience have been, but for me, I'm trying to remember when going to zoo, I was born in Rotterdam in the Netherlands, and I would go back summers to visit my family there. And there's a zoo in Rotterdam, and my grandparents, who didn't speak very much English, would take me there a lot as a kid. And I had just really wonderful memories of being there. I also had a traumatic event where there was a big bird, I don't know what kind of bird it was, escaped and was taller than me. Yeah. And it was like...
that emu.
It was like walking down, you know, one of these paths, and it came up to me and must have seen a bug in my hair and went pecking at my head.
It's probably just a peacock.
Maybe just a peacock. You're a little kid, right?
Who knows? I was like three or something like
cassowary.
That. But, you know, it drew blood. it was a dodo, guys.
There were like 37 cassowaries running wild through
chasing
the Rotterdam
after me. They're just going out right after me.
Yeah, no, I remember it too. We took a school trip to the Atlanta Zoo, and remember the lowland gorilla? Its name was Willie B. I totally remember that. It was named after, I think, the mayor of Atlanta, William Hartsfield.
That's
or something
so
like that.
Friggin' typical.
I know, right?
That they would do that. But I know, I was just wondering, like, I'm trying to remember, at what point did I start having ambivalence or mixed feelings or sadness going to zoos? Right. I know with my sons, my youngest loves animals, just loves them. He's you know, grown up saying that he wants to be David Attenborough in his life, you know, and the love is so pure. And so we, you know, going to a zoo to experience these animals, maybe some of which he's seen on David Attenborough documentaries or something like that, in person, really is a profound experience. But then you can also see this sort of sadness at seeing them in cages and all that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think that's what I think, you know, we should turn to is sort of like, why are we talking about this? What's the reason? I think this is a good lead into that, because it's about both this love, but also then the sense of disconnect. And how did that happen? Mm-hmm. Now, there was an historian, Vernon Kissling, really dove into this and looked at human societies and the nature of the relationship of those societies to animals.
Mm-hmm.
And so he sort of describes the evolution of this. So you go back pre-civilization, you have these hunter-gatherer periods, right? We're talking 10,000 years ago in many places of the world. That's all there was, pre-agriculture. You had small social groups, you had minimal impact on natural resources, and people would mostly just be gathering from the wild.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you move into the idea of, oh, kind of proto-agriculture. You've got some early domestication of crops and livestock, but it's still pretty small. There's villages, kin groups, some maybe some chief-like things going on. And you're starting to get then more of a sense of you know, we're exploiting the environment. We're doing more a sense of a control of the environment. And more, there's a little more of an us versus them going on.
Yeah, that's probably the era that this first zoo came into being, right? Where you're like flaunting your power with this display of exotic animals.
Yes, that could have been starting about that period of time. As soon as you can get this sort of social hierarchy developing, but then of course we become even more disconnected, right? We get more urbanization starts to occur, the rise of city states. And suddenly now you're creating these parks-like environments. So you're not necessarily out in nature, but you can kind of still macram of nature in these parks and game reserves and menagerie sort of stuff developing. And this is then when we really, you know, maybe you start getting more of these abusive relationships forming. And then finally, more of the modern era of large nation states. And it becomes more institutionalized even, not just the rich playgrounds and these sort of things.
And even seeing them as educational institutions,
yeah.
Like part of the social fabric, yeah. In a sense of a community. Yeah.
Yeah. And then this is, of course, the time now when, boy, we are really dominating nature in many ways with global trade and in previous, you know, episodes we've talked about like the feather hat craze.
Yeah.
So the ability to shoot animals in mass.
Yeah, causing extinctions.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So that's sort of how he kind of breaks down the human relationship between nature and animals and our social organization.
Yeah, and I guess I want to flag something we talked about earlier, which is it appears that this is pretty widespread, this dynamic of capturing and displaying wild animals, not for the purpose of domesticating them for food production or for, you know, resources or whatever, but purely as a form of status representation or entertainment or whatever it is. Seems like it was spread through societies all over the globe.
Mm-hmm.
But really before that, you know, as you were talking about the kind of hunter-gatherer stage, we didn't really see that. You know, the relationship with animals, and I'm generalizing here, obviously, seems to have been more reciprocal, low scale, low grade, and if anything, a reverence, a sense of connection that all animistic beliefs that all other beings in nature have spirit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, origin stories about people came from the animal world, these kind of things too. So they're one with us.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, like you're saying, you know, as soon as you, it seems like no matter where you go, as soon as you start getting the notion of there's a chief, there's a king, these status displays can be quite dramatic. I, for example, remember visiting the Hawaiian Islands, and there's this reverence for the Hawaiian culture, which is part of the Polynesian culture. And they spread sort of a proto-agricultural form with taro and pigs and things like this throughout the South Pacific. And when they get to these islands, there was a really big die-off of a lot of the species. And then today, you know, you can go to these sites where they explain what happened. So I remember being at this forest, this montane forest, where there are these birds, these honey creepers, which are this incredible bright red feathers. And they're really rare now, of course, endemic. But the Hawaiians would come up from the lowlands, and en masse, they would just slaughter thousands to make the red, almost like red royal, right? Royal red capes of the kings and the tribal chiefs, which are huge. And you can see them in like the Bishop Museum and stuff like that. I'm just thinking, oh my gosh, the thousands of birds that were just like massacred for the status symbol.
Mm-hmm.
Even among the so-called, you know, like beautiful little island, little civilization living in quote unquote harmony.
Right. That we sometimes tend to romanticize.
Romanticize, right. Right. Yeah. Right. Right.
Well, stepping further up in time and I guess level of exploitation, if you get to the Middle Ages, you can start to see almost like a blatant attempt to, hey, we got to rationalize this kind of behavior. So there was this philosopher, Albert the Great.
Okay.
I'm sure he was great.
His ideas were just amazing.
Yeah, well, I mean, you don't get the great added to your name without doing some at least really, really, really good stuff, right?
So, we're going to find out he named himself.
Yeah.
Well, check out this great observation of the difference between humans and animals.
Okay, here we go.
Animals are hairier.
Good observation.
He hasn't met the naked mole rat.
Their temperature is cooler.
Not goats. Goats are hotter.
Their heads are heavier.
All animals.
They are earthy. They don't laugh.
That's ridiculous.
And animal sperm, don't talk about flying.
Hey.
Animal sperm was unaffected by the heavenly bodies.
What does that even mean?
As opposed to human sperm, which is highly affected by okay.
Yeah, I mean, the phases of the moon? Oh my God. Hey,
when Venus is in retrograde, I'm nuts.
Hey, it's
no pun intended.
Albert the Great made these observations. Okay, now, Albert the Mediocre, you don't want to know what his observations were. So then there's this historian, Joyce Salisbury, who kind of documented some of this medieval philosophy of you know, these Western thinking about animals and the nature of animals. And they're so determined to separate humans as these intelligent, rational creatures, which we well know from previous episodes, we are highly irrational or just examining ourselves. And animals are these beasts, these instinctual, don't feel emotions, don't have feelings, and they would go to great lengths to point this out. And so they would this one's crazy to me. So like they were talking about a sheep that sees a wolf coming along. It doesn't feel fear or you know, like fear for its life and try to get away. What it has is some kind of like sixth or seventh sense that they called estimativa, which could perceive the intention of this wolf. So it's like some sort of...
That sounds like a pharmaceutical drug.
Yeah.
Estimativa. Give you a...
Or is that a...
Side effects may include getting killed by a wolf.
I think that's a pot strain, isn't it?
Sativa.
Estimativa.
Okay.
So it's like basically a way to say, oh, the sheep has no higher thought process, no ability to think or feel. And yeah, they just kind of believed this.
It makes it easier if you're slaughtering sheep, I guess, on your conscience, right?
Yeah, that's kind of the Middle Ages. Let's rationalize away our crummy behavior.
Wow.
Right, and then of course we just ramp that up with industrialization. As all that accelerated, we've taken both that rationalization and the scale of our impact and put it on steroids or whatever, estimativa.
Yeah, I mean, like so many other things in the fossil fuel era, you know, you commoditize, you move. Like, it's pretty hard to have a big empathetic relationship to a cow when the cow is a red thing in a styrofoam package that's been shrink-wrapped to your Walmart grocery store.
Everything in our power to not even associate that with a cow.
I think what happens if you're working in a slaughterhouse and you are just getting truckloads of these living creatures every day showing up, and your job is to kill them, hundreds and hundreds. I think that has got to be really difficult for the psyche. And it's nice to have some sort of philosophy, mythology that says, well, this is okay. And I think about this from the idea, like even people that like fish for fun, often we're told the story that the fish don't feel pain or something like that.
Right.
I think it's completely bogus. They have the same nervous systems kind of thing. We all evolved from as vertebrates. But it makes us feel better. And I think it's just a form of self-protection.
It does not make the fish feel better.
No. So yeah, once you get to the scale of...
So you're saying like a fisherman today needs to buy into the estimativa theory.
Yes, right. We need to promote that in the fishing industry and the fly catching industry.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you just think about the future, right? I mean, here we've done this at this scale. You know, we've got animal feedlots and using barbed wire everywhere. We're industrializing, basically manufacturing a mindset to animal food production. And by the way, destroying wild nature in order to support mm-hmm. the animals that we've domesticated in that way. But thinking about what is the future for our relationship with maybe more exotic animals that we're not just relating to because they are part of our economy or our food system or whatever. And it's these visions of using modern medical technology, gene sequencing, all this stuff, cloning to bring back extinct animals.
Yeah.
So
that's ultimate display.
Right.
I mean, geez, you're going beyond the hippo or the panda or the tiger king situation. It's like, I'm bringing on an extinct animal.
You're making me want to bring on a never having existed animal from Star Wars.
That's right. Yeah. No, I mean, it's just, but, getting back to the history of all this, as these societies get more complex and hierarchies start forming everywhere, whether it's between individuals or like cities showing off, right? Or drug lords, this becomes then this display of wealth and power at all kinds of scales, actually, and groups of organization.
Yeah, and I think our consciousness of animals has changed.
Yeah, we've learned more.
It's changed a lot, partly through the education about wild animals and through zoos and through other kinds of programs. I mean, think about the profound work of someone like Jane Goodall to help us understand. And on the one hand, we've kind of anthropomorphized animals maybe on some level. But on the other hand, I think we've learned to appreciate wild nature and animals in nature in a different way. We certainly have gone past thinking, well, the only difference is they're hairy, we're not,
Maybe even a decent chunk of people out there accept that we ourselves are animals.
Right.
That would have not entered the conversation previously.
Right. Yeah. And so if we are trying to be more mindful of that, maybe trying to see animals and wild nature as independent of us on some level, we are now still in this kind of predicament where we're conscientious, for example, about endangered species,
right?
And we're doing interventions to try to save the fate of endangered species, or maybe bring back ones that have already gone extinct. That's still that sort of that mindset of control, whether in this case we're like, we need to do that because of all the damage that we've done.
Right.
Guilt. We're still locked into this sense of that we control nature.
Now, right. Damn it, Asher. First you brought in the nuance. Now you're bringing in the paradox. Like, when does it end? Can't we just black and white this? Simple. There's always an answer.
I know. This is a really, really shitty show to be a part of. There's nothing
That's
easy
how it started. It was a shit show.
I'm sorry, audience. It's like, thanks for listening.
Every decision I've ever made in my entire life has been wrong. My life is the complete opposite of everything I want it to be.
If every instinct you have is wrong, then the opposite would have to be right.
So, I'm going to set the bar really low for us to begin with, which is, can we just maybe stop hanging elephants from railroad trestles? Can we just start there? That'd be good.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think we can get a broad agreement on the political spectrum about that.
Okay, we're done.
You got to take your Derek down that I saw when I approached the studio this morning.
Yeah, no, it's I'm already halfway decommissioned.
So, I mean, being facetious here, we do have examples of, and not quite the same thing, but on the spectrum, like bullfighting and cockfighting, dogfighting.
The cool thing is, when the bull wins, it's rewarded, right? It gets put out to pasture. But the elephant just got hung from the frickin' derrick.
Right. I guess that's progress.
We've advanced.
Is that progress?
Yeah.
Well, I do want to give you guys some real progress. I had to go through that elephant torture scenes with you all, and that was reported by Jill Lepore, as I said, in an article she wrote in The Atlantic that we'll put in the notes. But the article was not really there to just talk about elephant torture. It was there to talk about a really interesting development where there's a case that's about to be brought before the New York Court of Appeals that's going to argue that an elephant named Happy is being unlawfully detained in the Bronx Zoo under U.S. law because Happy is a person.
Oh, interesting.
So this case is really about granting personhood. I don't know if they would extend beyond elephants, what that precedent might be if that case were to be won by the plaintiffs. But this is not a new thing of granting personhood to something that, you know, you don't normally think of as a person, like corporations, for example, have been granted personhood. Yeah. You know, you've got groups arguing that embryos and fetuses should have personhood. The Yurok tribe in Northern California pronounced the Klamath River as a person in 2019. So this would be extension of personhood to an elephant.
Yeah, and that gets to like broader things around legal rights of nature. So there's been a whole movement underfoot of giving nature itself more broadly legal rights. And, you know, we saw that in Ecuador. And in the show notes, we'll add a link to an article that talked about a lot of examples, national examples, but also localized examples, including ones here in the United States of local communities trying to give elements of their natural environment these rights. And kind of similarly, there's this half earth idea and campaign to dedicate half of earth to wild nature for biodiversity recovery. So these are, in a sense, legal mechanisms.
Yeah. Well, it's a total shift in our thinking from the notion of the philosophers that we are so different and above and have dominion over these other creatures in nature to more of sort of a coexistence. So I think that's a critical thing to do. Like we're all in this together kind of thing.
Yeah, there's some really interesting ideas of coexistence that you can see springing up. The one that captured my attention was a story on the leopards that live in Mumbai, one of the biggest cities in the world. Mm-hmm. And you know, your first thought, especially if you've grown up under this domination of animals mindset, is leopards in my city, we better go shoot all of them, right? But really there's something going on there where I think people are learning to coexist. So there was this 2018 study of them, of the leopards following them around. And every once in a while, there is a problem where a leopard might attack somebody's pet or even a person. But this study found that the leopards are actually doing more good for public health than harm.
How so?
And it's because these leopards prey on stray dogs, and there's a decent percentage of those that have rabies. Hmm. And it's much more common for somebody to get...
Yeah, die of rabies.
Yeah, bitten and injured by a rabid dog or even killed than it is to suffer a leopard attack or something.
Oh, interesting.
So they actually estimated that could save up to 90 human lives a year by having this resident leopard population.
I gotta say, walking around the streets of Mumbai sounds a lot more exciting than walking around the streets of Corvallis between dogs with rabies and
we got wild turkeys.
That's true. We do have wild turkeys in our neighborhood.
You know, I read this really good book called The Cougar Conundrum: Sharing the World with a Successful Predator by this guy Tom Elbrock, who's a wildlife biologist. And it sort of had this callback to a cougar encounter that I had you guys about in a previous episode. And they are doing well, and they're spreading. You talk like
they're in Corvallis.
Cougars are in Corvallis. People have seen them down at the park. And so his idea in this book is really, we've got to look at how do we foster peaceful coexistence with these animals. Now, you may have to be more vigilant if you're out, you know, walking with a small child in their habitat or something. But the idea is to think about it as we're in relationship with, rather than we're going to dominate and kill you.
And I think that's the ecological view. You're seeing that there may be benefits, there may be adjustments of sort of attitude and behavior. And this is happening a bit in the farming communities as well, trying to coexist. Like if you run livestock, you know, I've got sheep out here and there's coyote kills. And there's a program with the county to try to do like a predator prevention as opposed to just going out and killing these predators, is to sort of learn how to coexist with them. Doing things like having guard dogs, having scent things that basically you mimic the scent of the coyotes because they're very territorial. So
helmets for the sheep.
Helmets too, for the sheep, right? neck guards.
Like when those anvils fall out of the sky and they can't hurt them.
But it's this ecological view, like what are the benefits of coyotes? Well, my God, the rodents they eat, you know, they're like, it's not like there's the sheep aren't attacking rodents. Okay, so I guess like that. But Herodes do, and hawks do, and so there's a lot going on in this ecosystem that the farm is just a part of. And so I think that view, then that story in Mumbai is a great one. If you just look beyond the immediate and look at those connections.
But I think it does take some honest grappling and some thinking through. There's this great story that was, I think, turned into a book called A Libertarian Walks Into a Bear, which is about this town in New Hampshire,
I think. Remember that.
That basically is like this libertarian enclave. A bunch of libertarians move there because they don't want to have government.
Live free or die, man.
In their business at all, right? Yeah. And so they're like, everybody kind of does their own thing. And they had a situation where, you know, bears are coming into the town. I don't know if it was like they weren't doing enough garbage pickup because, again, libertarians don't want to pay for service.
Yeah.
Or if it was, I know that some property owners in the area were like, oh, bears, cool, let's feed them.
Right.
So more and more bears are coming in, and some owners are like, we got to get rid of these bears, and others were, no, let's have the bears here. And it completely tore this town apart.
Well, there's no government left to figure it out.
Right, exactly. So it does warrant some conversation and discussion, right?
Yeah. Well, and I even think you see it creeping into our language all the time. I was watching this video of a guy building a log cabin, and there's one scene where he drags some logs up by tractor. The whole point of the video was watch me build this thing just with my hands and hand tools, and it was really well done, but he had this caveat where he said, oh, I would not have used the tractor to haul these logs. I really wish I could have used a horse instead. Mm. And I thought, oh, that's cool. But then I was thinking, use a horse instead of like work with a horse. Uh-huh. You know, it's like even our language is about domination often with animals rather than this is a being that I'm coexisting with. So yeah. I think there's a lot of change that needs to happen.
I think a lot of it goes back to the scale. So like if you're a dairy farmer nowadays, to make it, you're going to have hundreds of cows in a barn. You're going to be like throwing feed on, you're going to hook them up to machines. And when that cow has a calf, you're going to take the calf away because you got to get the milk out of her as fast as you can. And that's using a cow as opposed to, you know, a family cow. We've got one called Willow here that I'm kind of fond of. And Willow has a calf with her on her side. And when you want some milk, you go up to the sweetest little cow you've ever met and you take a little milk. But that's all you need. So that's working with Willow, who you just end up adoring and becoming part of your family. But that can only happen at the scale of, you know, this relationship with the animal that we've kind of lost a lot of those connections.
Yeah, and I guess maybe the last thing I would say is, I think I've talked to you guys before about Douglas Adams, one of my favorite authors.
Yeah, Hitchhiker's Guide.
Great zoologist.
Yeah, I probably read Hitchhiker's Guide.
Do we have any celebrity zoologists out there that we've insulted accidentally?
Well, Douglas is no longer with us, unfortunately. Yeah. But I read it. I read that series maybe every 5 years or so. Kind of puts me right with the universe. And spoiler alert for people who haven't read it, you know, one of the stories in there basically is that Earth is an advanced machine trying to answer the question, what is the question of life, the universe, and everything, right? So it's basically like an experiment that's being done.
Okay.
And it turns out that we sit here and think that we're running experiments on mice in cages, but it's actually the mice who are the observers of human behavior as part of this grand experiment, you know, so maybe we should all have a little bit of humility and can take on the mantle. Like, what if the mice are actually the ones that are smarter and are observing us? How are we behaving?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know I'm dumb as a rock.
Well, that's already been established.
Thanks for listening. We just gave you a whole bunch of do the opposite ideas so you can take action in your life and community. If that's too much at this time in your life, do something real simple. Give us a 5-star rating on Spotify or any other podcast app and hit the share button to let your friends know about Crazy Town.
All right, guys, with the perfection of CRISPR technologies, you know, we now have the ability to revive the most awesome megafauna of the late Pleistocene, right?
Sweet.
What do you want to see? Sabretooth?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like Sabretooth.
Giant ground sloths.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those are amazing.
Those are all in the works, but coming very soon are mammoths.
Mm-hmm. Oh, nice.
Okay.
Nice. The woolly ones.
Coming
right?
Where?
Yes. Yeah. Well, okay. That's what I'll get into. Okay. The problem is there's no ecosystem left to put these beautiful creatures. So got to keep them in captivity.
Jurassic Park, baby. That's
yep.
pretty good
one. Yep. Now, it's expensive. They got vet bills. They got hay bills.
Hey.
Yeah. Hey. But, and so in order to fund all this, there's got to be a return. There's got to be a way to get people to pay to want to see them. And this is where our today's sponsor for the show comes in. Mammoth Ring Enterprises. They have partnered with Luxor Hotel and Casino in Vegas and some of the greatest matadors in Spain today to bring spectators the most exciting experience since the gladiator times in ancient Rome. This is going to be huge. So, hey.
So instead of bullfighting, it's mammoth fighting? Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. Just imagine wow. Imagine this, okay? Mammoth chasing after matadors.
Yeah.
Who's going to win?
It's got to be a pretty big ring. That's the first thing I'm thinking.
I don't know, man. I'm firmly rooting for the mammoths.
Crazy town. Da, 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 crazy town.